Accession number 31393, Rule 4.
Commenderton, Rule 4.
Okay, well, as I said, that we were talking about the venom and the javelin. The venom was the last, I think, which was a converted from the day fighter. Very uncomfortable.
You say uncomfortable, just to fly?
Not in. Enough room. Crammed in, you know, terribly crammed in. I could never see myself getting out of the aeroplane except turning it upside down, jettisoning the canopy and falling out of it. That was extremely difficult.
And at this time, was there a push to get all weather operations underway as opposed to specific?
Yes, it was no longer called night fighters, it was all weather fighters. And we did, we could operate in all weather. I mean, as I said, with GCA, ground control approach, which was very accurate, and I know it was accurate because later when I became air traffic controller, I worked on it, and you could get an aircraft right onto the end of the runway without any problems. If the pilot would fly what you told him to fly, you would get him down very safely. So it was an all weather. In all weathers, we were operating rain, whatever, day, night. It was the beginning of the all-weather system, yeah.
Was that unpleasant to work in all kinds of poor weather?
It was. It was, but with the availability of good navigational equipment, the G, good ground control, good homing facilities, good final approach facilities, it wasn't too bad. And we always... always had to have a conversion airfield which, where the weather was better. So our fuel was calculated, okay, up to that point you have to stop the job and you either divert or you come back. So it was all right. It was a little, although it was peacetime and there was nobody shooting at you, I think the stress was more on the limited amount of fuel and the time. That was always on my mind. Very difficult to get used to, you know.
And the navigation, you obviously you'd need to use all from the ground control, really, wouldn't you, working in those?
Yes, only the G-Box was independent. I mean, that had the network of transmissions. You probably know how it works. It's like a spider's web, and you would lock on that, and you would see on your tube the interception of the thing, and you would read the numbers. You had a G-chart with the grids on it. You would know with great accuracy exactly where you are. But, you know, all these things can fail. They can fail. They would say G-chain, blue G-chain is out of use, being serviced and so on. But it was possible to operate all weather, yeah.
Did you operate with them? You mentioned flying close to the Iron Curtain. Did you operate in Germany at all?
I operated in Germany. Yes, I did. I did go to Germany for a short time at Wann. In fact, I tried to get to 68 Squadron, which was reformed in the 50s for a short time, but... I was then at Stratishall, and I said to my CEO, I wanted to go overseas. He said, you are overseas, you're a Czech. So I said, no, I really want to go to Germany because I want to buy a car without tax. So I did operate there, and on NATO exercises, and in Holland, we participated all on these, especially NATO exercises. I have, you know, intercepted the Bear, the Russian bomber, waved to them over the North Sea. And they waved to us, and I took a photograph of them, and they took a photograph of us. They were monitoring perhaps some naval activity, you know, during NATO operations, so that was all right.
So with those interceptions, it would just be intercepting and shadowing?
Intercepting, not too close, so they wouldn't really think that you're going to attack them, and shadowing, yes. And we would be actually using them as a target. They would tell us, we can vector you on a target of the Norwegian coast, and we would try to intercept them. Oh, yes, it's another bear flying over the Atlantic or something like that, yeah.
And the point being really to just almost show the Russians there, I would say. That
yes, that we are aware of them and we know they're there and they are being monitored, and so that was quite normal. It was, in a way, that was the only bit of fun you had in peacetime, to intercept anybody like that. Other than that, you were intercepting your own friends.
You said you'd done some groundwork from air traffic control?
Yes, I, well, you know, I was getting on in age, and I thought if I should ever fail my medical, I volunteered to do air traffic control. That was the nearest thing which would keep me to flying. So I did an air traffic controller's course at Shawbury, and then I came back. Oddly enough, I was posted exactly where I came from. Normally, if you left Stradishall, you were a traffic control course, they would post you to an unknown station where nobody knew you. But I was posted back, and all the boys knew me. Said, oh, God, you want to have him as a traffic controller? And then I did a GCA course, which is ground approach radar, which is usually the box at the side of the runway, which talks aircraft down in bad weather. I liked that very much because I was again looking at radar tubes and blips and talking aircraft. And I opened the door and I could see, yeah, there's a Hunter straight on the ground. So it was quite good.
Can you give me an idea of the kind of procedures that you would use when you were talking in aircraft?
Well, to start with, you would you would be handed over aircraft from the ground radar station, and you would be given approximately the position, and you would pick it up on your long-range radar in that truck, which you would pick up the little blip, and you would use an identification system where you would say, you would call him by his course of mission 29, would you turn right 90 degrees? And if he turned right 90 degrees, you knew it was him. There were other blips there as well. Okay, I've got you. And you would guide him into a little funnel and guide him into about a distance of 8 miles, descending him gradually, step descending him to about 4,000 or 3,000 feet. And when he entered the funnel, the next operator in the GCA truck would then have the final approach, which was a blown-up view, which was only showing the runway and the approach. You would then pick him up as he handed him. He was a GCA director, and then I was the final controller. So he would hand him over to me. I would, again, identify him and give him instructions. And at a point of about 3 miles, I would say, do not acknowledge any further instructions. I would give him continuous stokes on 10 left, 2 degrees, straight ahead, you know, descent, increase your descent, you're below the glide path, above the glide path, you're crossing the threshold of the runway, and that's how it was.
Sounds quite responsible.
It was very responsible, yes, because in a condition where he couldn't see the runway, it was bad weather, he was relying on you. And the first part of it, from 8 miles, let's say, to 4 miles, was reasonably safe. But from 4 miles, when you use the word, do not acknowledge further instructions, and you could tell that he was actually obeying your orders, whether he liked it or not. He said, increase your descent, reduce your descent, maintain your rate of descent. You kept him on these two, on the glide path and on the center line. And you see, half a mile from touchdown, he would then come, yeah, I can see the lights. So that was quite rewarding. I enjoyed it. It was rewarding, but very nerve-wracking. I tell you, you can get summer courses much quicker as an air traffic controller than a flying the machine, definitely.
So I think you left the RAF in 1961,
is that right? 60-something, yeah. I'm absolutely certain now myself, yes. And, yes, well, I retired. I have had problems, domestic problems, with my first wife, who was mentally ill. My job was extremely difficult. And also, through all this flying, from the beginning of the war to the end, all my work was done, 75% was at night. I developed insomnia problems. So they said, look, you can make a choice. You can have an early retirement. You will qualify for a small disability pension, which will be tax-free. Because I think that, you know, the difficulty, I mean, medical doctors really advised me on that at Halton and other places. I said, I think this is the right time, the right thing to do. And I did. I just retired. And I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do? And I saw this advert, London School of Flying at Elstree requires instructors and so on, so I jumped at it and they took me. David Ogilvy was the man in charge. It belonged to British Midland, or Derby Aviation as it was called. And we were training airline pilots. So, really, it wasn't much change for me, you know. I just changed my blazer, uniform, and we had a ground school, and we had chipmunks and Cherokees. And I stayed with them for about 10 years. I had Graham Hill, who was learning to fly there. Lua Maxwell from the James Bond film was learning to fly there. I was a very great friend with Graham Hill. He took me to a lot of races. And in fact, it's saddening to say, but on the simulator, he made continuously the same mistake which actually killed him. He would misset his altimeter. QNH expression is the setting of the altimeter which measures the altitude from sea level to the aircraft. QFE is the distance from the ground to the aircraft, where we all fly on sea to the aircraft because we should know what the ground is. He misset it. He plied into a golf course. And I remember telling him during one of his simulation practices, Graham, if you make this mistake in the air, depending on the terrain, you don't stand a chance. 300 feet difference makes a hell of a lot of difference. And we had students from abroad, you know, from Iraq and from Egypt, who were airline pilots, from Japan. In those days, the British airline pilot was valid in all parts of the world, so they came and paid a lot of money. A lot of the students, the British boys, were actually didn't have the money to pay for the training, but British Midland paid for it, and they would then fly it off for them. It was good fun.
Now, can you tell me what happened in 1990?
In 1990, in 1990 I returned with my wife. This is my second wife because my first wife died, to Czechoslovakia, and of course I was greeted as a hero, and that, you know, complete opposite attitude. But I wasn't blind. I mean, I was advanced in age, and I said to myself, this is not going to fool me. These people who are so nice to us, they are the hardcore of the communists. Havel cannot dismiss all his police. He said, if I dismiss all my officers, I have nobody left. So they turned, and I was very much aware of it. I had long political discussions. I said, look here, you wouldn't get to this rank unless you were a really good communist. And some people, you know, agreed. But gradually they were phased out. Well, it was a big reunification of all of us from all over the world, even Australia. And they put us through what was called a rehabilitation process, where they gave us back our rank, some compensation, because I got the rank of colonel, because if I stayed in the Air Force, in the Czech Air Force, all these years, that's what I would have been. And they were extremely nice. And we were there as guests of the Ministry of Defense, the new Minister of Defense. But every one of us knew. I said, you know, we had three coaches escorted by the police through the Prague town to get to the castle, through the traffic lights. And when we stopped, I couldn't resist going to the policeman. I said, do you know, if I had come 2 years ago, you would have shot me. He said, yes, I know.
How did ordinary kind of civilians...
The civilians were very nice. The civilians knew, and they rejected the communist behavior towards the former RAF boys. And of course, we met some of the ones who stayed there and survived, you know. They were in their uniforms, they kept their uniforms. So it was a great week. It was almost like going through the celebrating the end of the war again. It was great.
And how now is your contribution seen in Czechoslovakia?
Oh yes, with great respect. Many, many books have been written. I've written a book as well. and many books and all the thing which has been kept secret by the communists. This is why these books are serviceable and sellable, because all what the communists suppressed is coming into print and people reading about it.
So is it almost like it's been a hidden history to
the Yes, it's been a, it's been a hidden history. We were treated as traitors. Anybody who served in the Royal Air Force was treated by the communist regime as a traitor.
And they weren't aware of the contribution that you had.
The government was aware, but they had to suppress it because of Stalin. The people were aware. I mean, they had sons who returned from the Air Force who were flying, for goodness me, in the Battle of Britain, Spitfires, God knows what. But you know, they were not allowed to talk about it. So a lot of people knew about it, but it was suppressed. But as the new generation grew under the communist rule, which lasted 40 years. They were not allowed to know anything about it. They were told that, you know, we had some fighting troops with the British, but they were disloyal to the state. So it was very bad.
One last question then.
Yeah.
How do you feel now about your service and your interest in aviation? Do you still have that?
Oh, yes, very interested in aviation. I flew after that. I flew microlights. I flew anything which lands on wheels, on a skid. I have not flown in hot air balloon, because I think every landing is a crash landing, and I don't want to fly hang gliders. Well, I don't fly at all now, I retired. But when I finished flying with the flying school, I got terribly interested in microlights and ultralights, as they call them. And I flew the Regalo wing and the ordinary and the Shadow, which has been manufactured here. And I've been flying with the Flying Cub here in Norfolk until I retired. Eventually, I retired of my own accord because, sadly, I must say that the clubs were running short of money. And on one of my takeoffs, the engine lost revs, and I found, to cut a long story short, that the servicing has been shortcut. And I said, do I really want to kill myself? After 56 years of flying, do I really want to kill myself because they don't want to change the plugs or service the engine? So I'm still interested. I go and watch displays. Not so much, but we have good displays in Trafham, a model aircraft, and so on. And I took up gliding again, here, not far from here. Got my C, which was difficult to get. And, I've never lost interest in flying. When I see anything on the television to do with flying, I'm always watching it.
And how about your service with 68 Squadron?
Yes, I view that as very successful, and I'm very proud to have been on that squadron. And I think it was a good squadron. As I said to you before, we had good results. I enjoy being on the squadron, and I enjoyed very much being actually given the opportunity as the first of the allies of the British to be trusted with the most secret weapon in those days, with the airborne radar.